My name is Joyce Coleman. I'm here with Dr. Seymour Parter. The date is March 30th, 2004, and I will be talking to him about his career in the math and computer science departments. So perhaps you could begin by talking a little bit about your childhood and early years of schooling.
Well, I was born in Chicago, Illinois, a long time ago. I'm 76 years old. As far as teachers that inspired me, I had a terrific math teacher in high school. He's a remarkable man. He had the class laughing all the time, and many people who had no interest in mathematics took his class because they thought it was fun. And years later, I realized that when we weren't looking, he was teaching us a lot of mathematics, and certainly inspiring us. So now you want to know about my choice of Illinois Institute of Technology.
Well, actually, maybe I'll just ask you a little bit about your family, first of
okay.
all. Were academics strongly emphasized in your family?
My parents were both immigrants. My father was a big reader of books. My mother had been a big reader of books, but when she quit working and got married and had children, she stayed home a lot and didn't do much in that sort of thing. Neither one of them had anything that we would consider an education, although my father did teach me a trick of mathematics, which I've never been able to teach the undergraduates, but that's all right. So he was interested in all sorts of things, as was my mother, but they weren't formally educated at all.
Did they encourage you to do well in school?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. That was a prime thing, absolutely.
Okay.
And so.
Now, you would have been growing up in the Depression. Did the Depression affect your family at all?
We were relatively well off, that is to say, relative to the times of the Depression. My father owned a restaurant, so we never starved. I think it affected us only as much as it affected the mood of the country. I think we weren't wealthy by any means, but we were comfortable. We had no troubles.
Okay.
But certainly it affected the mood of the country and affected my parents' political views and things like that.
Okay.
Didn't affect us in the hard way.
Okay. So then in high school, in part because of this teacher, you became really interested in math.
Right.
Did you begin your undergraduate studies planning to major in math?
No, actually I began my undergraduate studies planning to major in physics. Something that modern day students wouldn't know anything about. In those days when you entered college, they gave you a book and they told you if you're majoring in this, this is what you take in this order. And they left a little room for what were called electives. And I discovered somewhere along the way that they had mismatched the physics and the math classes. And so I took a physics class in mechanics before I took a course in ordinary differential equations and discovered that if I'd only taken the course in ordinary differential equations, I could have slept through the physics course. As it is, I worked my tail off, got a respectable grade and all that. But I decided, no, I was going to switch to math and maybe reconsider the physics after that, and then I never came back.
Okay.
I have a minor in physics as an undergraduate.
Okay. And at that point, what were you thinking in terms of career that you could do with
math? Never thought about it at all. Every high school advisor I had told me I would starve to death if I went into math or physics, and I told them, never mind. That's what I want to do. That's what I'm going to do, and et cetera.
Now, during your undergraduate career, and this was just after World War II ended, so I would have thought that there might be a lot of jobs for scientists.
Not then. Jobs for scientists didn't develop until Sputnik went off.
Okay.
I mean, there were, well, that's not quite right. At the time I was getting my master's degree, this is 1951, there was suddenly a lot of jobs. I don't know how many relative, I have no idea the statistics nationwide, but we felt that there were a lot of jobs opening up in military-related things. I went to Los Alamos. One of my friends went to NSA and things like that.
Okay. But, that was a few years later then.
Oh, that's a few years later. That's 51.
Okay. Okay. So then after you're doing your undergraduate degree, you did a master's again at Illinois Institute of Technology. Now, why had you chosen that in the first place?
Well, let's see. That actually is relatively easy. As I said, my family owned a restaurant. My father died when I was 17, became sick when I was 15, so I went to work in the restaurant by about the time I was a sophomore in high school,
okay.
As well as going to school. So there was no way I could leave Chicago.
Okay.
And so my choice was University of Chicago or IIT. I wasn't going to go to Northwestern for a variety of reasons, including that in those days Northwestern had quotas about Jews and I wasn't even going to test it. So, and I chose IIT over Chicago perfectly honestly because I felt I couldn't hack Chicago and work 35 to 40 hours a week, whereas I thought I could do that at IIT.
So
I did.
35 to 40 hours. Now, were you supporting yourself or supporting your family or
siblings? Try to explain it, a little complicated. My father had a business partner who was in fact my cousin, although he was a man closer to my father's age than my age. And when my father took ill and when he died, my mother and I tried to fill in for my father. And so just supporting the family. She worked, I worked. I mean, I'm by no means a self-made man. Everybody helped. I mean, lots of people have helped me as I went along, but I worked. I would arrive in a restaurant at 7 or a quarter to 7 in the morning, serve breakfast, take the L to IIT, come back 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I would return at 4 in the afternoon and work till 11 o'clock at night. Oh. I worked all day Saturday. No, that's not right. I worked Saturday morning till about 2 in the afternoon. I'd come in again at 7, go home around 2 in the afternoon. On Sundays, I would come in at noon and open up and stay there till 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening.
Did you have trouble doing all your schoolwork while working so much?
Well, I've always believed I would have been a superstar if I'd have had time to study more. But no. Well, one of the things is, there's lots of time in a restaurant when it's quiet. Mm. You have to be there when it's quiet.
Yeah.
And so you can sit in a booth or at the counter and scribble away and do what you want to do. So I managed to study. Although, it's one of my jokes. There was a man, you talked about the veterans coming back. There was a man who was a veteran, had a wife and child, was also going to IIT, and we'd ride the L's together and sometimes study together. And one day he complained bitterly to me about the fact that he spent much more time studying than I did. And that, you know, he didn't think he was stupid and I was obviously doing better in school than he was. And so I explained to him that, you know, he's wrong. Because when I got on that L leaving the school, I spent the time on the L thinking about what had gone on. Whereas he was probably thinking about his wife and his kid and all sorts of other things. So, you know, if you think about it, you don't have to sit and scribble with a piece of paper or read a book to study. You can think. And so I managed.
Okay, so then for your master's, the reason you stayed at IIT was because you wanted to stay in Chicago.
Well, we sold the restaurant just at about the time I got the master's degree.
Okay.
And,
did you do a master's thesis?
Yes, I did a master's thesis.
Related to your later interests?
Nope, absolutely not. I was a pure mathematician. I wrote a master's thesis in a subject called topology.
Mm-hmm.
And under a then very famous topologist named Carl Menger. And haven't done any topology since then.
Now then, once you graduated, you worked as a staff member at the Los Alamos Scientific Lab from 51 to 57. How did you come to get this position?
this was a period of time when the Korean War was starting. I was in the peculiar position of I was 18 in June of 45, which is to say, that's just between the end of the war in Europe and the end of the war in Japan. I was 1A, I took a physical in late June or early July of 45. They declared me 1A, everything was fine. For various reasons, I didn't get called up until February of 46. That time the war was definitely over. They took one look at my health record and said, you go home, you've got allergies, we don't want you, you're 4F. So I never went to serve, but then when the Korean War broke out, they decided I was good and healthy in 1A and I decided that was dirty pool. So I looked around and our chairman of the department had been to a math society meeting and had been approached by people from Los Alamos that they were looking for people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied for the job.
Okay, so this was a way of avoiding serving.
In Korea.
Okay. And what was the nature of your position at Los Alamos?
What does that mean?
Or what were you doing? What were you hired to do?
Compute.
Okay. Were they setting up a computing lab there?
You have to know something about the early days of computing. Yes and no. The group that I was hired for had been computing in a very complicated way ever since the middle of the, I mean, ever since the beginning of the Manhattan Project. They were now developing into more sophisticated computing. More sophisticated computing in 1951 would make anybody today laugh their head off, but they were. And so I was in the section that was involved in more sophisticated computing, although I won't take all your time to describe to you how truly rudimentary it is by comparison what we have now, okay?
Okay. And it was Preston Hammer who hired you, correct?
Preston Hammer hired me.
Okay. Now, you spent, I guess, 2 years full-time and then 4 years part-time?
No. I have a very strange career. I was a full-time employee of the lab all the time from 51 to 57. Because, again, one of my bad jokes, not particularly because I was smart. Everybody at Los Alamos is smart. But because I was a bachelor and no one gave a hoot whether I was there or not there, I was one of the people selected to travel to what were then the big computers. And so in August of 50, I came there in March of 51. In October of 51, I was sent to Washington, D.C. to work on a machine called the SEAC, Standards Eastern Automatic Computer. I won't describe that either, it's pretty rudimentary, but very sophisticated compared to what we already had in Los Alamos. Mm-hmm. And so I became one of the experts in large-scale scientific computing at that point. There weren't very many of us. And so I was usually sent around to various places in, when? May, April, somewhere in the spring of 53, a group of us, NYU had just gotten a computer, a UNIVAC, and they set up something called the AEC Computing Center under a big contract with the AEC, that stands for Atomic Energy Commission, if, you know, your readers will know. Anyway, and so a group of us went off to NYU to work on this project. Like every other project that we ever tried to do, it lasted and lasted and lasted. Everybody else went home except for me and a man that I worked with a great deal. And so I was there in September and October. So I started to sit in on two classes. Mm-hmm. In about November, my boss, mentor, etc., one of the many people that helped me along, called me up and he said, we've been talking about you and you're going to be there a long time. And we know you're sitting in on two classes. Why don't you go become a registered graduate student? People applying to graduate school today would be totally shocked. One of the things which did happen and influenced my life and career was that because of my Los Alamos connection and my coming in that way, my friends at NYU were not my fellow students, but were the faculty.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I had friends among the students, but my friends were the faculty. Mm-hmm. And so after this man called me up and told me this, I went to a very distinguished mathematician named Peter Lax, who's a member of the National Academy, every honor you could think of. It wasn't then. He was still a young man. He's only a year older than I am. And I said, Peter, just talk to Bob. And he said that I should go become a registered graduate student. He said, great idea, let's go. Took me across the street, I talked to a dean, I was a registered graduate student.
Wow.
Graduate students today would die for that. Anyway, but that's having influence, having friends in the right places, right? Anyway, so then in May or June of 54, I went home being Los Alamos, and I was now a registered student. I'd been taking courses for two semesters. And the lab very generously, for the next few years, found ways to send me back to NYU.
Okay.
So, but I was always working for NYU, for the lab, and I was always on the payroll.
Okay.
So all the time, I've never been in a position where I went to school and didn't work. I was always working. Right.
Now, what were your research interests at that point?
Well, at that point, you see, I mean, I had been introduced to computers.
Okay.
And into scientific computing. And so I shifted completely from topology into scientific computation and applied mathematics.
Okay.
That was not, I mean, as a student, those were my interests as a student were very broad. Again, my PhD thesis, again, was not in numerical analysis, which is my field of interest. It was in a totally different field, again, pure mathematics. But so my
my development had been through Los Alamos to get involved in applied math and computing and all that. But as a student, I was just a student. Students don't think about it. They just do what they do and take the courses they take, etc. Mm-hmm.
So when you say scientific computing, what did scientific computing mean in the mid-50s?
You don't really want me to answer that question. I work for Los Alamos. Figure it out, okay?
Okay.
Okay? I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Now, once you graduated, you had positions at Indiana University for 2 years.
Try MIT first.
MIT. You're an instructor at MIT. I think I missed that one on the outline.
You did.
Then Indiana University, Cornell, Stanford. Why these schools? Why were you moving around?
Well, the old bad joke is, of course, some people can't hold a job, but it's not quite true. let's see. I was finishing up my degree, and I had no intention except to return to Los Alamos.
Okay.
None whatsoever. A very good friend of mine who had gone to Los Alamos with me, had been a student with me at IIT, and had left and was now working for one of the aerospace companies. And you have to understand, this is now 1956-57, the academic year of 56-57. Big takeoff on missiles was taking place, etc. Big explosion in aerospace technology, mm-hmm. etc. And lots of companies being created. And so this friend called me and he said, come on, you cannot go back to Los Alamos. You're a bachelor, you'll die there. Why don't you come to work for us? And I said, yeah, I don't really want to. I want to go back to the lab. They've been good to me. He said, no, you got to at least give us a try. So I went out and I talked to him. And I was horrified. I had no way was I going to go to work for those people. I mean, you have to understand, they were a startup company, and if you looked at anything, you looked at a stoplight on the street and you said, gee, that's interesting, you could see their brain clicking, now how can we write a proposal to get money for him to do this research? No, I'm not getting involved in that. But I did, as a result of that trip, take the time out to think about what I wanted to do seriously. My thesis advisor had spoken to me about considering an academic career, and I turned him down. I went back and I said to him, I've reconsidered. Mm-hmm. He made 3 phone calls. I got a job at MIT. Again, the world has changed. I mean, well, you have to understand, again, my thesis advisor was an important, influential man. But he made 3 phone calls. I don't know where the other 2 were, but he called MIT. And I ended up going to MIT.
Okay.
And I was there for a year.
Okay. And that was mainly teaching, or both teaching and research?
I had a joint appointment between the computing center and the, and the math department, so I taught less courses than most people, and I was supposed to do research.
Okay. And then from there, you went to Indiana University. I don't know, do you want to talk about each of those?
Well, Indiana, I spent 2 years at Indiana. I was very happy there. All of this is due to my, you have to understand something. Let's put this in dates, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I keep telling you stories, but that's the way it is. I got married in October of 57.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly September, maybe August of 57, was when Sputnik went up.
Mm.
Suddenly, there were lots of people looking for people who could compute, and I was a hot commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And Indiana hired me again jointly. I was the associate director of the Research Computing Center and an assistant professor of mathematics.
Okay.
And I stayed there 2 years. I had a very good time there. I got along very well with everybody, even in this dual role. But then I got approached by Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people at Cornell that I wanted to think and talk to with and work with, and so I went to Cornell.
Okay. And from there, you then went to Stanford.
Well, that was a year's leave from Cornell
to
Stanford.
Okay, so just 1 year.
Yeah, and then from there, I came here.
Okay. Okay. Now, here's just some background on computer science. So at each of these universities in the late 50s, they do have something, a computing center. So
yes.
That's happening in the 50s then?
That's happening in the 50s.
Okay.
I know this is on tape, but if you read what I sent you about the mm-hmm. development of the CS department here, 50s, 60s, this is the 60s. I went to Cornell in 60. If you got back to about 58, just about then, IBM built the machine whose name I don't remember, 650. They built a machine called the 650.
Mm-hmm.
And for experts, it was a drum machine, two-address drum machine. Nobody, not even our computer science majors, know what I'm talking about when I say that, but that's okay. And IBM went on a binge. It was a very clever idea. They went to the universities and they said, we'll give you a 650. Give it to you. We ask only one thing in return. You teach a course in computing.
Yeah.
So universities all went crazy. Something free. They took it. Then they had to look for people to teach these courses. So that was, people who knew anything about computing were a very hot commodity. They really were.
Okay.
And so, yes, at Indiana, there was, at MIT, of course, it had a history. And MIT had built a machine called the Whirlwind much earlier. They'd had a history already of big machines in computing.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana had a 650. You know, I don't remember what Stanford, Cornell had a 650. I don't remember what Stanford had. Stanford, the emergence, Stanford at the time I went there, I was technically a visitor to what was called the Division of Computer Science in the math department, and after I left, it split off
mm-hmm.
and became a separate department.
Okay.
So all these schools, and the same is true here. Preston had been brought here, I don't know when Preston was brought here, but maybe in 56 or 57 to be director of the Computing Center.
Okay. Which, what, the Numerical Analysis Laboratory?
Well, then it was called the Numerical Analysis Laboratory, and...
Later it changed its name several
right.
times.
Right.
Okay. Now, what kind of applications would take place on a, I mean, would sociologists be using it for a computer for number crunching, or is this like central administration of a university?
No. At Indiana, I really don't know what went on at MIT. They sort of left me alone so much that I have no idea what went on there in their computing center. At Indiana, for example, Indiana, the computing center was run by a committee. The director was a man named Merritt, Lynn Merritt. Lynn Merritt was a chemist who did X-ray crystallography,
mm-hmm.
and they did lots of number crunching. X-ray crystallography, there's lots and lots of number crunching.
Okay.
And then there was another man whose name I've totally forgotten, but it'll come to me in a minute or two. And he, again, was a chemist. He did quantum chemistry.
Okay.
The quantum chemists, even here, they spend all their life doing something we call computing eigenvalues, and bigger systems all the time. There was another man who was an astronomer. There was another man from the business school.
Okay.
I don't think there's anybody from the social sciences yet involved.
Okay.
Although, that's not true. There was a big linguistics project that was going on.
Is this at Indiana?
At Indiana.
Okay.
Using the computer.
Okay.
Val Zeps, who's by now retired from this university, was a graduate student when I was there doing computational linguistics at Indiana.
So
came here later.
Okay, but the university wouldn't say have been using a computer to do payroll or anything?
Oh, they did, but we had nothing to do with that.
Okay, separate computer systems.
Separate okay. computer systems.
Okay.
Most universities fought to keep it that way. Once people got their hands on the research computer, they wouldn't let the administrators always wanted it, but they always kept them away from it.
Okay. So, now you came in 1963 to UW.
Right.
The Numerical Analysis Department had been set up in 1961 by Preston Hammer. What do you know about him, why he was able to set that up?
This is gossip, you understand. I mean, no, seriously, I'm very serious. This should be taken with a big grain of salt because I wasn't here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I really was not here. So, you know, it's hearsay and guessing and everything else. Preston was a remarkable man, absolutely remarkable man, but he could get under people's nerves. We had another remarkable man here who would also get on people's nerves. His name's R.H. Bing, who was a very, very, very distinguished topologist,
mm-hmm.
chairman of the department here at one time, member of the National Academy, president of the American Mathematical Society. Preston decided he was going to teach a course which had the word topology in it, but was really numerical approximation theory.
Okay.
R.H. went through the roof. They had a battle. My impression is that Preston, who had made very few friends in the math department, went then to Ingram, who was the dean,
mm-hmm.
and said, and Ingram, as you may know, had set up computing here a long, long time ago. And I never met Ingram, so all of this is really hearsay. I know
sure.
nothing about it,
yeah.
in fact. And he said, I can't function this way. I need a department in numerical analysis, and he got it. Math was perfectly happy to say go, and so.
Okay.
Now, again, when I say math was much smaller than it is now. So it was very easy for RH to have a reasonable amount of influence, and but you know, there are no good guys, there are no evil people in this story. Everyone was doing what they thought was best for their view of science, etc.
Yeah.
Okay.
And from what I've heard in other places, Hammer was doing different types of math than people in the department. So in terms of his research interests, they just
Preston's research interests when I first met him were. Preston always was different. I mean, when I met him at Los Alamos, he was certainly not doing anything connected to the lab. I mean, his research was his own research. He ran the group. He did the administrative work, but his research was out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And when he came here, he changed his mind. He said, I'm going to worry about computing. And so he went into research, which was closely related to computing. Now, nobody else here ever did anything like that. So in that sense, he was certainly not doing what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, why did you accept Stephen Kleene's offer to come here in 63?
How much dirty linen do you want?
As much as you want to give, I mean, and no more.
Well, let's put it this way. The reason I was on leave from Cornell to go to Stanford was because Cornell was going crazy, in my opinion. And so I did not wish to go back to Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And I better tell you more. When I came to Cornell, my first year, Barclay Rosser was away. You know who Barclay Rosser
is?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Barclay was away being the director of something called IDA, which is Institute for Defense Analysis, and it's located in Princeton. And in those days, its existence was even secret, but okay. They did the same sort of thing NSA does.
Mm-hmm.
And the second year I was there, he was a chair. Now, strangely enough, in my first year there, I had a great coup. I solved a great problem in pure mathematics, but I had come to it because I was interested in it because I realized it had implications for what I was doing.
And you're talking about Cornell now, right?
Cornell.
Okay.
And I solved this problem, and suddenly I became even a hotter property. I both knew computing and could solve this big problem.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, when Rosser returned, Rosser, whose training, as you may know, was in logic, but he knew a great deal about computing and applied mathematics, and he decided that there ought to be an applied math department. Now, you walk into any pure math department in the country and you say, we're going to create an applied mathematician math department, and they'll go after you with knives and forks and big bolo knives, etc. That's heresy. So there was a big fight. And I got caught in the middle.
Okay.
Namely, because I was suddenly a hot property, I was getting offers from other places.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Cornell department was faced with the question of whether to promote me or not. And Rosser really wanted it because he really wanted applied math to be developed. They turned down my promotion. I said, okay, I have this offer to go to Stanford for a year. I'll go to Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, while I was away, they kicked Rosser out.
Mm.
Rosser and Kleene had been very, very good friends.
Okay.
They had been school together. In fact, the joke is that no one knew which thesis was which between Rosser and Kleene. And so, and Rosser had already been offered the position as director of the Math Research Center.
Mm-hmm.
And the story I know is that he called up Kleene at midnight one night and said, okay, I'm taking it. And then I got a call from Kleene, a call from Kleene saying, Rosser tells me you'd be interested in leaving Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know what's going on at Cornell, but he does. I better. So I took the interview and decided I would come here.
Okay. Now, this jumps a. Actually, no, this is the same year you arrived. I think it's 1963 when the department's name changes from analysis to computer sciences.
That's what Rosser's doing.
Okay.
Rosser was given appointments in math and computers and numerical analysis and director of the Math Research Center.
Okay.
And it practically our first faculty meeting, executive committee meeting. I came in as an associate professor, so I was an executive committee. He said, you know, this is crazy. We don't need a department of numerical analysis. That's a subset of mathematics. But computing's going off. We need a department of computer science.
Okay.
So we changed the name.
And do you remember why it was computer sciences rather than computer science?
I have no idea.
Okay, that seems to set...
Everybody sets people off, but that's what it is. Well, as a matter of fact, I can guess. I mean, I think it was just an accident, but but that's never mind.
Okay. Now, early members of the department include Preston Hammer, Stephen Kleene, Barclay Rosser, Eldo Koenig. I think we've talked about most of those people, except, well, actually, I'd like to hear a bit more about Barclay Rosser and about the Math Research Center. Can you talk a bit about...
You're going to have me almost as many hours as Art if you keep this up. Well, Barclay, all these men are interesting men. Barclay was a very interesting man. You could love him and hate him at the same time. And he was a Southern gentleman, mm-hmm. born and raised in Florida, and had written a brilliant PhD thesis in logic at under Church at Princeton, as did Kleene. And when the war broke out, the war for people my age is World War II, he went to the ballistics lab at Aberdeen, the Aberdeen ballistics lab, and he got involved in ballistics. No missiles. These are, we're talking about cannons. This is, missiles come much later. No, he's talking about expert in ballistic things, and even wrote a book about him. And learned about computing, and you have to understand, computing outside of Los Alamos during World War II was really elementary. I mean, it's a sexist thing to say, but except that it's true. Most computing was done by women sitting at a calculator, and they would be given a piece of paper, they would do a calculation, they would put a number down, they would pass the piece of paper to the next woman, she would look at it, do a calculation, pass it over to the next woman. That's how it went. Mm-hmm. But he became interested in computing, and he certainly became aware of some of the elementary, early computing machines. Mm-hmm. They did have some relatively sophisticated, for those days, computers at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds. I think it was the Aberdeen Proving Grounds. You might check on that. anyway, and then Barclay went to Cornell, and he did work in number theory. He did work in logic. He did work in ballistics, did all sorts of things, and proved to be both a very capable administrator as well as a very capable mathematician. And did a lot of computing. And, he tried to compute the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. That doesn't mean anything to most people, but to mathematicians it's an important thing. Mm-hmm. And in those days, with the primitive machines that he had, and this is, we're talking about before 1960, he became, well, at one point he was the director of, it was an institute, I guess it's called the Institute for Numerical Analysis at UCLA.
Okay.
And they did a lot of very, very important things, which still have had an impact today on numerical analysis and scientific computation. But while he was there, he attempted to compute the zeros. Mm-hmm. You can't compute all the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, there are infinitely many of them, but to compute some of the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. And so he was a very distinguished man, and as I say, he was the director at IDA when in the 60s. I don't know how long he was there. And then he came here as the director of the Math Research Center in 63. Langer had retired.
Okay.
Now, again, with no meaning to denigrate Langer, who was, first of all, a very great mathematician, and who created the Math Research Center. But partly because the world had changed, that is to say, by 1960, there were jobs for mathematicians left and right. I mean, they were, so the best ones could do what they wanted to do. When Langer created the Math Research Center, he had a permanent staff and he had visitors. The reputation of the Math Research Center at that time was on the visitors. The visitors were the great ones. People at the center were thought of as employees. They had no university connection except being employees of the Math Research Center. Rosser came in and said, no, in today's market you cannot do that. You just can't do that. So anybody who has a permanent appointment at the Math Research Center is also going to have a tenure appointment in some department. And that department's going to decide all by themselves.
Okay.
And so several of the then permanent staff of the Math Research Center left, and several of them got tenure appointments.
Okay.
So he changed the whole character of what it was. Now, the visitors were still great, don't get me wrong. We still went after, but the basic staff itself was also a very, very high caliber.
Okay.
And even today, people tell me, you know, you start chasing down an idea and you end up, there's a paper which says done at the Math Research Center, you know. And Barclay was a man, as I say, he came in 63? I don't know when we got deeply involved in the war in Vietnam, but once we got deeply involved in the war in Vietnam, he was the wrong man in the wrong place. He wasn't designed to be facing a student revolt, which he couldn't understand. I mean, many of us couldn't understand it. The Math Research Center was a pure research center. Now, it is true that in Langer's day, they would occasionally have people come in and do things for the Army. Mm-hmm. Rosser changed all that. One of the things he almost told the Army almost immediately is, we are not going to be what's called a body shop. We are not going to come here and we're not going to solve your problems.
Okay.
You can come here and tell us your problems. We'll give you some ideas. We'll even send people out to visit you for a day or two, or even a week.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to solve all your problems.
Yeah.
And during the time Rosser was here, there was absolutely no classified work done here. Mm-hmm. Now, people here may have had clearances. I don't know all the people. Actually, I was almost never, until very late in the game, I was not a member of the Math Research Center.
Okay.
Rosser and I both sort of agreed we were going to stay away from each other for a while. I mean, we were close to each other because we were both in computer science and both in math, but we weren't going to get that close. I mean, it was a tacit agreement. We never spoke about it.
Okay.
But to my knowledge, there was no classified work done here.
Okay.
The people did go to visit military installations and would spend maybe a week. In fact, one of my favorite stories is I know somebody who went and they showed him what they were doing and he said, well, this is what you ought to do. And he said, we can't do that. Can you do that? He said, no, I'm not going to do that for you. I'm too busy, you know. Go do it. Go hire somebody. Don't leave me alone, you know. This is what you have to do. So, he really took all the heat about the Math Research Center and all that. And it was a bad time for him. And
I heard that he was really vilified, and that even
he was truly vilified.
People would make negative comments to his wife if she walked down the street.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was terrible, and she suffered really rather badly. I mean, she hadn't wanted to leave Cornell. She built a life there, and. Again, to give you an idea, one of the things which I had to tell her at one point, because she didn't know this, I don't know why, because Rosser and I were not the kind of people to sit down and have a beer together. I mean, we come out of totally different backgrounds, and we admired each other, respected each other professionally, and, you know, this official function, we would have a cup of coffee together or maybe even a drink, but we weren't that close. But for some reason, on one occasion, he started to tell me about his early days of courting Annetta and telling me about, here he was this poor guy about to go off to graduate school. And she was already embarking on a distinguished career as a violinist. Mm-hmm. And he was going to ask her to give that up. And you don't know how hard that was. And, you know, I that got me, because, you know, this man that I considered steeled, so to speak, came through with that. And I did tell that story to Annetta at some point. She suffered a great deal, and he was vilified. And, you know, and nobody knows what he really thought. One of the things that practically nobody knows, we know, people who know, but his son, who's now a professor of economics at some school in Virginia, came home from the, whatever it was, 64? No, it couldn't have been 60. Well, maybe it was 64. 68 Democratic Convention in Chicago with a cracked head. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Where the Rossers felt about lots of things is unclear, but he was certainly vilified.
Okay.
And it was very hard on him.
Okay.
Okay?
I also see the name Eldo Koenig among the early members. What, did he stay for a long time or not?
Oh, yes. He stayed until he retired.
Oh, really? Okay. What was his area? I mean, very briefly.
I can't even tell you. Again, you have to understand that one of the things which happened There are advantages to being in the forefront of something, and there are disadvantages. We were in the forefront of building a computer science department. I think Purdue came ahead of us, and maybe Stanford came ahead of us, and later Cornell came, but we were among the top four or five schools that had a computer science department.
And by that you mean the first four or five? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you hired anybody who had any interest in computing. And Eldo was a professor of electrical engineering who had an interest in computing, and he suffered because didn't take very long for computing to be an art, a science, all on its own. And you either, you know, learn fast, because these kids who were going to school and learning were just way ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tried to work in the theory of computing. See, I stuck to scientific computing. I never got near the other. Just to give you an idea of how much things changed. When I was at Indiana, I wrote a paper with a colleague at Indiana on something called embedding graphs in the sphere. Never mind what it is. However, there are two places in that paper, and I personally wrote those sentences, saying we do not see how this could be automated,
mm-hmm.
this process which we're describing. We're imagining a human being carrying out this process. When I came here, there was a man named Robert Targin who got an award for not only automating this process, but analyzing carefully how much its complexity was, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a survey article about it, and one of the graduate students came to me and said, it says here you did this and this, tell me about it. So I told her about it, and I was shocked. She instantly saw at least a way in which it could be automated.
Mm.
I had no idea at the time we wrote the paper how to do that, and I was an expert in computing. So Eldo got passed by, and he's one of the few people I know to retire as an associate professor.
Okay.
He never made full professor.
Okay. Now, throughout the 60s, then, the department is growing pretty quickly.
Right.
Now, in the written document that you prepared, and this is going to be in your folder so people can read it, you list people who arrive and the years they come. So it seems like there's a problem attracting enough faculty.
Oh, yes.
Why is that?
Well, there's this new discipline, four departments or five departments in the country giving PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you going to get them from? They're not out there. You can do part of what we did, namely, you go after people who come from other fields and have shown an interest in computing. That's me. I have a PhD in mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did computing. There's a man named Bob Fitzwater who was a chemist. Suddenly got all involved in computing. We hired him. Larry Travis has a PhD in philosophy.
Really?
Yeah. Len Ure had a PhD in psychology, but had gotten involved in computing. This is what we did in the early days. Again, that's part of being among the first. You grab the people who know something.
Yeah.
But if you, and after a while, and particularly when I was chairman, we were looking for people who had degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody's suddenly building a computer science department. And there aren't very many people with degrees,
yeah.
And so you're struggling.
Okay.
Yeah, that's.
At the same time, you're also shifting. Initially, it's all numerical analysis, and you're shifting towards more sort of systems.
Right. Well, that was the thing to do.
Where were the people who had that systems background? Where were they coming from?
Well.
the four or five programs, or.
Well, they came from all. Yeah. Well, let's see. There are two people who I think were the first ones we had in systems. This Bob Fitzwater that I mentioned before was a chemist, and he had an interest in systems.
Mm-hmm.
Two people that we hired that had an interest, the first two people, three people that we hired that had an interest. As I mentioned in my document, Ralph London's the first one to have a PhD in computer science.
65 you hired him, I think?
I don't know. You'll have to look at
that.
It was
about 65.
Yeah. I went through and checked the dates when I did it. And then Ed Desitels, who had his degree from Purdue,
mm-hmm.
and Tad Pinkerton, who came from Michigan. They all were systems people in some sense or other. They had degrees in computer science, they had been exposed. Again, in those days, in most departments of computer science was just growing. There was not this sharp delineation, this is systems, this is this. Everybody learned everything they could.
Okay.
And everybody learned systems, everybody learned this, everybody learned that. That's not true in our department now. CS You can go through and not learn anything about systems. You can go through and not learn anything about programming languages. You certainly can go through and not learn anything about numerical analysis. I mean, that's easy. So, you know, again, as the field expands and more of the sub-disciplines become rigid, then you can talk about someone learning this. But in the early days, everybody learned everything.
Okay.
They did, not me. I was over.
Okay. Now, did anybody ever, was there ever a discussion about keeping it as more of a numerical analysis-based approach?
No. We all agreed. That was the amazing thing. There was no question. I mean, okay. I knew. When I was chair, I knew. I was not building a numerical analysis department. I never even tried to hire another numerical analyst when I was chair. We were always trying to hire people in other areas.
Okay.
We knew that's where we had to go.
Okay. Okay, we're now going to talk a little bit about the computer science department's physical facilities. First of all, where was the department housed when you first came to Madison?
When I first came to Madison, there was a bungalow on Park Street, which is roughly where the loading dock for Vilas Hall is, and that's where it was housed.
Okay. Were they sufficient for the department's needs?
There were six of us, four of us, three of us. I don't know how many there were. Yeah, it was sufficient.
Okay. And at what point do you know when the Computer Sciences and Statistics building is built? What point the... I can probably look that up. It's probably around 70, maybe?
If you have my Vita somewhere. I actually, when I was chair, I actually had my office in that building.
Okay. And your chair is 68 to 70, so
yeah.
It's... Okay.
So it was already built by 68 to 70, and I can't tell you when it was actually built, because I think I was on leave in 67.
Okay.
66, 67, I was on leave, right.
Okay. Now, what about the computers that the department had when you first got to campus?
Don't ask me. I absolutely don't remember.
Really? Okay. But they were punch cards. Can you just talk about the process of using... I mean, did
you... Oh, sure. You had these IBM punch cards. And... you would have a big drawer, which was full of these IBM punch cards, which gave directions. Let me back off. When I went to Los Alamos, they was developing what we call the CPC, card program calculator.
Mm-hmm.
And the way this card program calculator worked was, first of all, the big boards wired with all kinds of wires in them. But this machine could do addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and square roots. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And decisions. Decisions, namely, is A bigger than B, etc.
Okay.
And what it would do is you would run sequentially, you would run these cards, and then you would get to a decision. And so you would ask the machine, is A bigger than B? And the answer was yes, it would keep going. The answer was no, the machine would stop. And then you knew to pull that drawer of cards out, take another drawer of cards, and start feeding these other drawer of cards, because you had to go somewhere else, okay? You had to do something else. Well, the same sort of thing went on inside these new big machines, say inside the 650. I'm sure the first machine here was a 650, an IBM 650. At one point, we either got or were negotiating to get a Burroughs 5500. I don't know when that happened or whether we ever got it or not. It said it was a big bone of contention.
Okay.
So these machines, for example, when I said it was a two-address machine, what a two-address machine did was it said, well, there's a machine... there's a register in the computer called an adder. And the kind of instruction you could give in these two addresses is you could say, you give the machine two addresses. And so you say, take a number from this address, that's the name of a box, put it in the adder.
Mm-hmm.
Or take a number from this address, multiply it by the number that's in the adder, or add it to the adder, or divide it.
Okay.
And then put the result in the next address.
Okay.
And then normally it went along in sequence. But then you could change the direction. Say, no, now take your next instruction from this. That the thing that first shocked me, since I've been dealing with these cards which stopped, was that when the first machines were built, the instructions were also stored in the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So that there were numbers in the machine and instructions in the machine. So you would then now change and say, no, I'll take your next instruction from there instead of from here. And so that's the sort of thing that went on in those days. And so you would write these cards out, and you would take several drawers of cards and go down to the computing center,
mm-hmm.
fill out a form, hand it to the guy, He would take it, and you'd come back and find some pages of numbers in your box.
Hmm.
Everybody had a little cubby hole,
mm-hmm.
you know, like kids at nursery school. And you would come back and find these numbers in your box.
So if you'd made some sort of very silly error on
line one. Oh, it would stop and tell you.
Yeah.
It would stop and tell you.
So you got very good at not making small errors?
No, you got very good at fixing small errors.
Okay.
They still make errors.
But it's, I mean, now it just sounds very strange, because now you can write a program, compile it in 3 seconds.
That's right, and it's all algebra. Error. You write out algebraic statements. And
yeah.
You don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had to break it down to every little thing. Add this to this, multiply this by this.
So you're only using assembly language. You're not using anything.
Not even assembly language, basic machine language. We lived on basic, in the early days, we lived on basic machine language. Then they invented assembly language.
Wow.
That was a big construction.
Now undergraduates hate learning assembly language.
That's right.
It seems so basic.
And they can't see what they're going to do with it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, can you clarify the relationship between the numerical analysis department and the numerical analysis laboratory?
No. The laboratory was what ran the computer.
Okay.
They ran the computer.
So that was quite separate from the department?
No, it was run by the department.
Until 64?
Until...
That's when Merv Muller...
Oh, it's until Merv Muller came.
Okay.
That was split off. Right.
Okay. So at this point, the numerical analysis laboratory, it's...
Died. Simply died.
Okay. But it was only doing computation for people in that department. It was not...
No, it did computation for anybody in the
okay,
university.
Okay, so the chemist might show up, or the physicist.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the big problems, which nobody understood at the time, was it's a great story of greed. As I told you, IBM gave away these machines.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things which universities thought was, well, now this is great. We will... use these machines for our research projects. In the meantime, before then, they'd been taking their research projects, which needed computing, to some central IBM computing center or something like that, and then, no, we'll do our research projects on this.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that was part of the sale pitch, I think. I never heard the sale pitch. I wasn't a big enough big shot to hear what IBM was telling the university. But, well, a few years later, suddenly the federal auditors showed up, and they said, you can't do that. You can't do that for the following reason. Well, what they were doing was they were charging these contracts, which were all government contracts, the same rate that IBM Labs would have been charging.
Okay.
So they were making money on that. That is money. Okay. And they said, you can't do that because there's a federal law which says the government has got to get the cheapest rate you give any customer. And you're giving your teaching classes free computing.
Oh.
So you cannot charge the contracts because they're government contracts. Well, I don't know how they ever settled that. They fought that out for years. Every university I know of fought that out with the government auditors for years. But they did computing for everybody. Someone would show up and say, you know, I've got this project. Can I compute on it? And they would say, sure, we'll charge you so much and so much. And,
okay.
And we'll even give you some we'll give you some programming help if you want and things like this.
Okay. So, okay, that makes sense.
And the same was true with Cornell when I was there.
Okay.
And Indiana, for that matter, all of them.
Okay. Now, and you don't know about later equipment, how it's upgraded, things like that. Okay. Maybe we could talk a bit about curriculum and students. Now, you mentioned in your written draft Numerical Analysis 132, an early course taught by Charles Davidson and Eldo Koenig.
Mm-hmm.
Was this sort of the introductory course that students took?
No. There were the two there's still the two introductory courses, 302 and 132.
Mm-hmm.
And the vision was that 302 was a course for future computer science majors.
Okay.
And you could go on. 132 was actually, you could not use 132 to go on.
Okay.
If you wanted to go on, you had to take, it was thought of, and Eldo and Charlie hated us for saying this, it was thought of as a computer appreciation course, much as there are music appreciation courses in the music school, etc. But
okay.
It did introduce people to computing. Then later, as it developed, as the machines developed, you realize, you mentioned assembly language and I mentioned machine language. That's where we were in those days. And so teaching people what computing was teaching them about that at the most rudimentary level, because these were people who were not going to go on.
Yeah.
And so, but then as the machines developed and other things developed, then at one point the business school said, hey, we want our students to take 132. Mm-hmm. And I think 132 is still a required course for the business school, although I'm not sure. I'm out of those things. Mm-hmm. And so it changed, although it was still a terminal course in, from the CS department's point of view, and I don't know if it is still or not anymore. You might look in the timetable and see what it says about it. But it became a course, and so now it's a course on PCs.
Okay.
Strictly a course about PCs. So it's developed in that way. But it always had a large enrollment, and Charlie and Eldo did a terrific job with it.
Okay. Now, 302, is that a course that you ever taught?
No. Actually, I taught it once. I taught it once. And turned out I picked a bad year.
Which year did you pick?
Well, I don't remember the year, but it was in the middle of the TAA strike that I was teaching. And that was something.
I definitely want to ask you about the TAA strike a bit later on.
Okay.
Were there any textbooks at the time? What were you teaching out of?
There was a textbook, and I cannot remember what it was at all. Okay. By the time I taught it late. I mean.
Okay. And how about for your numerical analysis courses?
Oh, we always had textbooks for that.
Okay.
For the elementary ones. We developed, that's not quite right, we developed a graduate program with no textbooks. For example, there's a course 713, which is now taught in the math department and taught out of textbooks. But I wrote a set of notes for it, which were used forever. There's a course 717, and Carl DeBoer wrote a set of notes for it and kept rewriting the notes, and they're a terrific set of notes, but there's no textbook for that course.
Okay.
And there was a 844, I think it was, an elliptic partial differential equations that I taught. And again, I taught that at first with no notes at all. God help those students. And then I prepared some notes on it, et cetera.
Okay. Okay.
But for the undergraduate courses, there were books by then.
Okay. So the students are learning basic and then... They're learning machine language.
And they're learning machine language and they're learning Fortran.
Fortran, okay.
Fortran. I don't think we taught a course. They might have learned... I don't know if they ever taught them... I taught Fortran when I taught 302.
Okay.
I learned basic. You don't want to hear how I learned basic.
Okay. Who were the students taking these courses? I mean,
well, at that time they were mostly CS majors. It was a new concept. Although, you know, again, some people had the idea, well, this is a coming thing, and so I'm in another field, but I will take it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. But mostly there were people who thought they were going to be CS majors.
Okay.
Was not an enormous enrollment, but which is good because we did not have an enormous faculty.
Yeah. Well, I talked to somebody and she took courses, I think, in the mid-60s, and she said that if you'd done a few courses, you could get jobs anywhere, especially other places on campus.
Oh, yeah.
Really easy to hire people.
I mean, you know, so when you're hot, you're hot.
It must have been nice.
Yes.
It's a little different now.
It's a lot different now. Yeah.
Department awarded its first PhD in 1965, and I was interested to see that it went to Sister Mary Kenneth Keller.
Sister Mary Kenneth Keller, right.
Do you remember her at all?
Barely. She was a student of Preston's.
Okay.
And she's shown up for, I think she's still alive.
I think she's actually deceased. I tried to find her on the web.
And, but she was an interesting woman, and she learned numerical analysis, and I think she just finished, I came in 63, so I guess I must have seen her around. She never took a course with me. I think she was busy writing her thesis by the time I came. And, Sister Mary Kenneth Keller, right. One of our prides.
I just thought it was interesting that a nun
That's right. First one, the host to a nun, right.
do you have any recollections of your early graduate students in the mid-60s?
Oh, sure. I mean, I can almost name all my students. I don't know if I can name them in order of their getting their degrees. One of my students was a man named Fred Doerr, and I've lost Fred. I don't know what's happened to him. He's a remarkable man. These are math majors.
Mm-hmm.
There's a man named Pierre Jamet, who was a Frenchman, who got a PhD in computer science. That's an interesting story. All these guys are interesting. Pierre's particularly interesting, but if you got time, I'll tell you about him. Pierre came with a letter from a great, great, a French mathematician named Jacques Lyons. Lyons is now dead. Saying this young man should study numerical analysis with you. He really can't fit into our program, but basically it was, he's good enough for you, but not good enough for me. But that's okay. I mean, it's all right. And Pierre and I hit it off very, very well. And you see, he worked for the French Atomic Energy Commission, and uh-huh. they wanted him to learn numerical analysis. And they didn't care whether he got a degree or not, because an American degree doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
But he wanted a degree. So he stuck it out, and he got a PhD in numerical analysis. And then the story is, when he got back to France, he attended the Lyon seminar on some occasions and did some very nice work.
Mm-hmm.
So the French establishment by that point decided he really ought to join the establishment, become an academician in the French establishment. So he got a PhD in a French PhD. He had two PhDs. Then he tried an academic job and decided he didn't like it. For lots of reasons. One is he would have had to move, and his wife had a job, and he had a very nice house outside of Paris. And he had the best job in the world. He was the mathematical advisor to the director of some AEC lab. And I asked him once what that meant. And he says, it means I can do any damn thing I please, except bother the programmers. So I got to do my own programming, but I can do anything I please. So, and then, I can almost tell you when it was, 1981. Now, for strange reasons, which I'll never understand, Pierre had his undergraduate work at École Polytechnique, mm-hmm. not at École Normale. So that's why he was second class. Although some of the great French mathematicians came out of École Polytechnique, still, by the 60s, it was École Normale that mattered.
Okay.
And for that reason, which I've never understood, he was in the military, technically in the military. So all the time he worked for the French AEC, his retirement program was in the military. In 1980 or 81, the French army decided to clean house. And so they said, anybody who's over 45 and hasn't made general, they give him a golden parachute.
Mm-hmm.
Pierre said, I had no choice. I had to take it. It was so good, I had to take it. So he quit his job. Now, Pierre was a big, strapping guy who went mountain climbing all the time, etc. So he looked in the mountain climbing magazines, and he applied for a job as a guide leading tours in Nepal. He got it. And the story of how he got it is the following. He gets a letter from this California company. He gets a letter from the president from the California company saying, the president's going to be in London on such and such a day. we'll pay your way over to London, have lunch with him, and have you an interview with him. So he goes to London. They have a lovely interview. Everybody's fine. Everybody's happy. Great. And so the president of the company says to him, you know, we put this ad in the Mountaineering magazine. We need 11 people. Mm-hmm. We get 2,000 applications. So we don't even interview everybody. We only interview the people that are interesting. So Pierre says, that makes sense. Why am I interesting? He says, aha, you have two PhDs. So I always tell my students, one's good, but two are better.
Okay, please go on.
So Alfred Carasso was a meteorology student here, but he took my course in partial differential numerical methods for partial differential equations, and decided to shift majors, and he now works at NIST, which is the Modern National Bureau of Standards.
Okay.
And let's see, who else is there? Oh. Then there's a student named Gershon Kittim, who was an Israeli. He's now a professor at Duke in the computer science department, but he's totally given up numerical analysis. He does his degree is in computer science. He designs chips and things like that. Mm. He really went into the computer science business.
Another math student was John Baxley. John's at Wake Forest.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't do numerical analysis either. He does ordinary differential equations and things like that. His thesis was a mixture of ordinary differential equations and numerical methods. And who else in those early days? Well, then there was John Cerruti and Mike Stuart-Walt, who were together as students. And they were computer science. John is at Los Alamos. He's a group leader. And Mike was at Los Alamos and is now at the National Science Foundation.
Okay.
And there were two more that were CS students, David Kamowitz and... Oh, no. David was computer science, and what can I think of her name? Naomi. Her name now is Naomi Naik. I've already forgotten her original name. and Naomi was a math major. And they were, again, both students at the same time. unfortunately, David died of some sort of lymphatic cancer. What are this? I've had three Korean students, all who are back in Korea and have academic positions there. And one other young lady who's Puerto Rican, and she's back in Puerto Rico with an academic position in Puerto Rico.
It sounds like your graduate students had pretty good careers afterwards. Did they mostly work in academia?
No. As I said, Pierre was not in academia. Mm. Fred went to Los Alamos first, and then he went to Intel, and then I lost him. I don't know where he is now. He had a lot of personal problems. And Alfred was in academia for a while, but then he went to NIST.
Mm-hmm.
John Cerruti went originally to Union Carbide and then to Los Alamos.
Okay.
Mike went straight to Los Alamos and then went to the National Science Foundation. My three Korean students all went immediately back into academia. Korea, I don't know what's going on now, but their degrees are almost recent in my eyes, maybe 1990 or somewhere around there. And Korea was where we were when I started out. They were pouring money into education and research and expanding their universities. And of course, Puerto Rico is doing the same. This young lady, her degree is actually not either department. She has an interdisciplinary degree, and she came back and is back in Puerto Rico with an academic job. So the only ones with academic jobs are, well, let's see, there's John Baxley, Gershon Kittim. I can't remember her name even. Why can't I remember her name? Anyway, it'll come to me. She's in Puerto Rico, and then the three Koreans. So that's six, and then I think I've had about 15 students.
Okay.
So.
I wonder now if you might be willing to talk about the student protest movement for a while, just your recollections of it. Now, you were chair of the computer science department from 68 until 70, so you probably had direct interaction with some of the protesters.
Well, the protests took two forms. One was the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
and one was the TAA. And, of course, the leadership was more or less mixed. I mean, there were lots of people that were involved in both.
Mm-hmm.
The Vietnam War was, I won't call it strange. Perhaps you saw that recently there was a thing in the paper that they'd had a forum on going back to talking about those days, and Soglin spoke in it, and Lee Zeldin
mm-hmm.
yelled up and all that. And, you know, some of those people made the point we were making then. One of the things that was happening was everybody was against the war. And, so they would announce a protest march. And the students were, as far as I could tell, were caught in a bind. Namely, if you didn't go and the protest fizzled, it looked like there was no antagonism to the war. But if you went, you knew that certain people would go out, break windows, cause violence, etc., and that you were providing cover for them.
Mm.
But you had to go anyway, because the other thing was you were really against the war. So this went on for quite a while. And of course, the Math Research Center became a focal point of it.
Mm-hmm.
And can I call a man a liar? Yes. James Rowan wrote many things for the Cardinal, which were just full of lies about what was going on at the Math Research Center. And he knew better because he'd been told. Of course, he didn't believe, but that's another matter. Whether he believed the things he wrote or not, I won't say, because I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know they were lies, so.
Okay. Now, you said that students were all opposed to the war. How about the faculty?
Faculty, well, nah. I don't know the whole faculty. That's the first thing, okay?
Oh, yes. The ones you knew.
The ones I knew were all opposed to the war. There was no... but
okay.
Both math... Well, as a matter of fact, for example, after the Kent State thing,
mm-hmm.
computer science set up a table for people to sign a protest petition. Right there in our main office, we had this. But we in math were sort of a... We in math had many fights among ourselves because there were people who did blame the Math Research Center and people who didn't blame the Math Research Center.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the kind of, I can only call it fuzzy thinking. I really mean it by lots of people. The extreme example to me was, and I won't tell you the name of the man, but there's a professor of physics who had a big atomic energy project. And I met him once in Los Alamos. We were sitting there talking. Summertime, I used to go out there every summer, and he was out there. And he was really complaining about the Math Research Center, how evil it was, et cetera. I said, what are you talking about? It's just not true, what you're saying. And he said, but there's a perception. I said, what about the perception of you? You've got this enormous, Atomic Energy Commission project. It's more money than I've got, and, you know. He said, but you know what I do. What I'm doing is peaceful stuff. I said, and I know what I do, and it's peaceful stuff. No. And, you know, the thing that really got me at those days, and we had many arguments within the math department, and, you know, people had this notion that somehow the NSF was pure, and the Army wasn't, and the Navy wasn't. Now, I tell you, it's a true story, all right? There's a man named Smale, a very distinguished mathematician. In fact, he was here 1 month ago, gave some lectures here. And he protested the war very strongly. Mm-hmm. I think he lay down on the tracks outside of Fort Ord or something, or marched in front of the tracks or whatever. And congressmen from Indiana heard about this and raised hell with NSF to take away his grant, and they did. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, there was a statistician at Berkeley who had an ONR grant, Office of Naval Research grant. And he also protested, signed a petition. And so the Navy sent him a letter saying, well, it seems that you, you know, are protesting what our government's doing, and so maybe you want to give up your contract. And he wrote him back a letter and said, I thought you hired me to do this contract because you wanted the research done. You either want the research done or you don't. They sent him back and said, okay, everything's fine. So there were no good guys in this. There were different people who buckled into different kinds of pressures.
Yeah.
And I always used to try to tell my colleagues, look, if you believe your government's evil, then the whole damn government's evil. You know, you can't pick out a part and say this is good and say that part's bad, you know. But we did have many, many arguments about it within the faculty of the math department. Mm-hmm. And we certainly had many arguments with the students. And now, and the focus, of course, was the Math Research Center in many ways. So we were in the center of it. And as I say, it was a very mixed time for us. I'll tell you one last joke about it, and I'll let it go. And my wife said to me one day, well, what do the students want from you? And I said, well, that's simple. They want me to end the war. And she said, why don't you end the war? And I said, you're right. Why don't I end the war?
Why didn't you end the war?
Why didn't I end the war? Right. Well, there you go.
So among the faculty who opposed the war, was there a difference in opinion about how the students were showing their opposition?
That was hard to say. Yeah, I guess so, although never got came out that way. We never talked about that somehow, at least not sharply.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the TAA strike is another matter. There had been this nascent TAA, which had, I don't know, 10% of the TAs as members at one point. Mm-hmm. And then this remarkable man who was a member of the Senate or the House of Representatives or something, you know, here in the state of Wisconsin, who's now Judge Shabazz, made a statement like, we ought to charge all these out-of-state TAs, we ought to charge them full tuition. Mm-hmm. Guess what happened? Instantaneously, the TAA membership went up to about 90% of the TAs. So then the TAs demanded that they be allowed to unionize. Now, that's against state law.
Why was it against state law?
It is. It still is.
Really?
Yeah.
Because of their particular function?
Somehow there's a certain class of employees that say, we're not allowed to unionize either. Okay. Faculty isn't allowed to unionize. But Ed Young, who's been vilified by many people, on his own said, okay, we'll negotiate with you. Mm-hmm. And negotiations dragged on, and they got nasty, and so there was a strike. And again, the TAA leadership, in my opinion, was absolutely crazy. I mean, I think the TAs right now have a very legitimate complaint about what's happening to their health costs and all that. But then, they weren't concerned. There were two things they were concerned about. And again, I will have to tell you, we're pure. The math department, no, I'm very serious when I say this. The math department was pure in the following sense. There were departments, I'll name them if you want me to, although I have no evidence of this. This is hearsay. Mm-hmm. Who would hire a TA and then next year say, well, now we're going to consider you alongside all the others who are applying.
Okay.
So they had no permanence.
Okay.
They could lose their TA-ship after 1 year. So they lived in dread. They didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
And they were abused by those departments in that sense. And so one of the things which came out, which was good from the TAA contract, is they got a 4-year guarantee.
Okay.
And you know, you come in as a TA, you've got 4 years guaranteed, and maybe longer, but at least 4 years. But there were, you know, those were heady times. And so, for example, the TAs in the English department refused to teach grammar. They were teaching Marxism. And you know what the English department did?
No.
They dropped grammar.
Really?
They really did. We don't know. There's no grammar course. There's no first-year grammar course at this university. What they did was they came before the faculty. In those days, we didn't have a faculty senate. We had a faculty.
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, these kids are now well enough educated in these basics from high school, we don't have to teach it anymore. Mm. And they just cut it out, and they got rid of a lot of TAs. I mean, they couldn't cope with it.
Okay.
There were other departments where, indeed, the TAs wanted the, quote, control over what was being taught. And that, of course, upset the faculty, as you can imagine.
Well, what about the math and CS TAs? Were they ever teaching material they weren't supposed to teach?
No.
Okay.
But they sympathized. I mean, some of them sympathized with the with that attitude. In fact, there was one young man, I even remember his name, you know, who was very much on that side of things. And I talked to him a lot, and I said, look, this is crazy. Between us, who should decide what should be taught in the basic numerical class? Of course, you or me. He said, well, that's different. I said, why? Why do you think the English faculty is less competent at what they do than I am at what I do? Well, that was different. So, it really became very fierce. And on the other hand, the leadership of the TAA was totally, they had no sense of reality. I give you one example. Now, again, the math department TAs and the CS department TAs reacted very differently in this situation.
Okay.
I was chair of computer science.
Mm-hmm.
And I did something which I've been told was probably illegal, but never mind, I did it anyway. I called the whole department together as we were going into it, and I said, look, we're going into this, and everybody's going to do what they feel they have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, my view is any course is not your course, or even my course, it's the department's course. The department has its program, it then assigns courses to different people, but it's not my course or your course, it's the department's course.
Mm-hmm.
So, as chair, I'm going to do my best to see to it that all the courses are taught.
Okay.
You may not like that, but that's what I'm going to do. The important thing is, when this is all over, we damn well better realize that we're going to go back to being students and faculty together. And if we all yell at each other the wrong way, we're not going to make it. So, let's calm that down. Well, no one did that in math, and indeed there were students who stood out there and yelled at you as you were going into the office.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, well, there are two that I could name, and I'd rather not. One of them is now a very good mathematician and is a professor at Milwaukee. He was a student of R.H. Bing, who I mentioned before. Now, R.H. was politically pretty conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And this student was out there on the ramparts. And when it was all over, he left. He went off and taught, for a couple of years, he taught high school math in Boston. And when he asked why he left, he said, Bing will kill me, what do I? And everyone tried to tell him, Bing doesn't give a damn about your politics.
Mm-hmm.
He only cares about topology. For God's sakes, go back. And Bing said, what the hell is he doing? Who cares, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But this was, you know, how it was. Now, there's another student who I know yelled at me a great deal, later had to take a course with me. We got along, but he never finished. And, you know...
so some students' careers really were interrupted by...
Some students... Well, you know, again, how do I know? I mean, the student that I know that didn't finish, I don't know whether he would have made it or not anyway.
Yeah.
How do I know? You know?
What was he yelling you about? At you about?
Oh, I was walking past the picket line.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
And crossing the picket line or walking by?
Cross it.
Okay.
Crossing it. Going into my office, doing... I taught.
Okay.
No, in fact, again, a typical example, I was teaching, during the strike, I was teaching for somebody else's class as well as my own, 302.
Okay.
And I taught my own course in 302, and I was taking over some TA's course in 302, and it was in North Hall.
Mm-hmm.
So I was coming from North Hall back to Van Vleck, and I crossed in front of the Lincoln statue in front of Bascom,
yeah.
And there were a group of students marching around with placards, and among them were... man named Robertson, I can't remember his first name. He was a TAA representative in computer science, and this same man who I mentioned went off to Boston, etc. And so they came over to me to ask me how it was going, how was enrollment holding up, and things like this. And so I told them, in my class, enrollment was holding up fine. I was there, and you know, the guy from computer science just accepted this as information, and the guy from math was screaming at me, you know. You know, I don't know whether it was my words that did it or not, or maybe they were just more materialistic or whatever, but the computer science students and the math and the faculty really never came to serious yelling at each other or anything like that. And, you know, we crossed picket lines, no question about it. And and I learned a great thing. You can cross a picket line and not get zapped by lightning. No, you have to understand, I grew up not believing that. But I learned that. You can cross a picket line and not get zapped. It's okay.
Now, what were the demands of the TAA? You said that the leadership was too radical.
Well, there were the two sets, the two directions of the demands. One was that you, you know, that they should have some permanence guarantees.
Okay.
And the other was that they would have more control of the classes.
Okay. And that was an official demand.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And again, to give you an example, we were going into what was going to be the last meeting. In those days, we all met in the union. The whole faculty came to the union. There was no faculty senate.
Hmm.
And there was something, and I don't remember what it had. It had to do with grievances or something like that, that the TAs could make grievance, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And I called in Robertson, who's a professor at Indiana, I guess, in computer science now, and I said, look, if I move fast, the very beginning of the meeting, I can get the floor and I can make the following proposal, which is not what you guys are asking for, but it's what I think you can get.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, well, I'll go talk to leadership. He came back and he said, no, they think they can make it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it turned out that my next door neighbor is Ted Finman. And Ted Finman was, if anything, the leader of the, quote, moderate supporters of the TAA,
okay.
The moderate ones, not. I mean, there were others who were more violently in favor of the TAA.
Yeah.
Right? And I had driven in that morning with Ted. And I knew they didn't have a chance in hell of getting what they wanted.
Yeah.
And I just looked at them and said, okay, I won't do it. I didn't do it, you know? So, you know, it's that sense that I think that, you know, they had a misconception as to what the faculty would give them. And then, at the second TAA strike, I was no longer chairman then, they still had this misconception.
Hmm.
Now, because one of the things which they did, and I don't think they ever realized it, they really, part of their big argument during the strike and after the strike and going into the second strike was, well, we do all the teaching. The faculty are just fat, you know, they're what do you call it, you know, and so they don't do any work. We do all the work, et cetera, et cetera. Well, faculty didn't like that. Because you can imagine the faculty didn't like, strange, you know. And so, indeed, there was a meeting in the ninth floor lounge of the TAs, and they invited the faculty to come. And I came and Anatole came. You know Anatole?
I've heard his name.
Okay. So, Henry? Tell us Henry's name. Anyway, this was one of the leaders of the TAA, and he got up and he was talking. And he said, oh, faculty will support us in this.
Mm-hmm.
And Anatole got up and said, Henry, you're wrong. You guys have insulted the faculty so much, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Henry got up and made some depreciating remarks about Anatole. Anatole's just saying this because we never listened to him enough, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I got up and I said the same thing. And I said, I have something to tell you. When Anatole and I tell you the same thing about what the faculty thinks, you better listen. But they didn't, and so they lost that strike. And one of the things which people don't really realize what happened. Now, I gotta try to remember a name. Chancellor after Ed Young. He was a chemist.
Shane.
During the first TAA strike, the TAA had gotten the Teamsters to support them.
Okay.
And the Teamsters refused to deliver these big tubes of carbon dioxide, which they needed to cool things in the chemistry labs.
Okay.
Shane never forgot. when he was chairman and they had the second strike, he crushed them.
Really?
He said, if the law does not give you the right to strike, Ed Young did it on his own. I'm not recognizing you anymore, et cetera, et cetera.
And it's mainly because of that delivery.
Well, I don't know. That I don't know. I don't know Shane well enough to know that. I know the two things are true. That delivery was not made.
And that was really crucially hurt the department?
Crucially hurt the chemistry department.
Okay. Did that destroy experiments?
I don't know.
Okay.
But anyway, that's the story that went around. All I know is that Shane took a very different attitude than Ed Young. Ed Young was an economist who believed in collective bargaining. Shane was a great man and a very good chancellor. But he was not putting up with that nonsense. Yeah.
No. Did the second strike, the one in 1980, cause more bitterness than first one?
Yeah, I think. In the first one was all tied up. The war was going on. There was this going on. some of their complaints were legitimate. You know, they were in certain departments. They were being treated badly. The demand for 4 years guarantee was perfectly reasonable. Some of the other demands weren't. There were very mixed feelings going on. It was a very confused time. By the second strike, we'd had a couple of years of the TAA screaming at the professors, you know, in print. They don't do any work. We do all the work.
Okay.
You know. Give you an idea of how unrealistic the students were. I still remember, I was sitting in my office and I was listening to two students talking outside. And one of them was saying, now, why in the hell do I have to worry about what the faculty thinks of me? You know, I said to myself, you're going to get a degree and you're going to need a letter of recommendation. Do you know that? Do you have any sense of that? You know, totally unrealistic about, you know, how things might work or not work.
Yeah.
You know, anyway.
Okay. Was there lasting bitterness between faculty and students?
No. Okay. It was not, you know, it was not personalized.
Okay.
At least not on our part, as far as I know. I mean, I cannot speak for the whole faculty. But in the math department and computer science, certainly the faculty was, as I say, R.H. Bing, who's among the most conservative members of the department, all cared about was mathematics, you know?
Yeah.
What are you bugging me for? I don't care what you do. You want to waste your time, that's fine, but I want you to do mathematics, you know?
Okay. Now, before we end for today, I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about the student protest movement, and in particular about the bombing of Sterling Hall.
Okay, in the first place, I was not in town when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
you probably, I don't know if you know this, maybe you do, maybe you don't. The Sterling Hall bombing was done by a method that is now famous, namely loading up a truck with fertilizer and setting it off. The truck that was used was actually Larry Travis's van, which was stolen.
I heard about that.
Larry left the door open. actually, it's rather funny to me because there were pictures in the newspaper of the effect on Burge Hall.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Los Alamos at the time it happened. My friends at Los Alamos sat down and estimated the extent of how large the bomb was. I mean, that's their business. They just sat down and calculated it. But again, how does one describe it? We knew and we had tried as hard as we could to make it clear that the Math Research Center was not doing any classified work, pure research project. But the propaganda against it was rather fierce. I mean, I give you two examples. there was a little booklet which came out with four offers. One of them was Jim Rowan, and one of them was Ed Zeidman, whom I knew. Ed Zeidman was a student in computer science. His thesis advisor was John Halton.
Mm-hmm.
John Halton was part-time at the Math Research Center and part-time at the Computer Science Department. His main area of interest was the Monte Carlo method.
Okay.
Now, this little booklet was describing MRC. It had two paragraphs. The first paragraph was, there's research being done at the Math Research Center on Monte Carlo method, with John Halton, et cetera. Zeidman was doing his thesis in Monte Carlo methods. Second paragraph said, the Monte Carlo method was developed at Los Alamos Laboratory during the war to help build atom bombs. Now, both statements are true. Both statements are absolutely true.
Okay.
Now, what's the implication?
That it's still
right.
For military purposes.
Right. Of course, it wasn't. It was by now I called Rowan on this once. He said he didn't write that. I said, I know you didn't write this. Ed Zeidman wrote that. I know that. But you wrote it. You put your name on the damn thing.
Yeah.
He said, what, am I responsible for everything that my name is on? I said, I am. I write a joint paper. I am.
Yeah.
You know? When I asked Ed Zeidman about it, he said, well, we have to fight. I said, but it's dishonest. He said, no. I said, this is academia. You have to have, I know, arguments can be made, but they have to be honest. He said, no. Academia is now part of the real world. Everything goes.
I wonder how that affected his relationship with Halton.
I have no idea.
Hmm.
I mean, he finished. He got his degree. But, but you know, it was that sort of thing. Everything was in a state of flux. And that was one thing which I considered. And then there was a report, another report, written about research at MRC. And what they had done is they had gone through titles of MRC reports and made comments about each one of them.
Okay.
And so, for example, they commented on a report written by a friend of mine who was in the department but was partly supported by the Math Research Center one semester, and he wrote this report, and it was on what we call predator-prey equations.
Okay.
Predator-prey equations, you know, someone decided to use this name. Actually, they are used in ecological studies. They're used enormously in ecological studies. And then there was a remark as well, we know who the predator was and we know who the prey was. Now, you know, fun is fun, but this is serious business.
Yeah.
And so as far as I'm concerned, Four Nuts got carried away with all this.
Yeah.
And they did things which they shouldn't have done. And indefensible. And a man got killed. Years of research of other people were totally destroyed.
Mm. The Math Research Center wasn't even as badly hurt as other departments, correct?
Physics was hurt. A man named Borchers, who simply gave up research and became an assistant dean or something, his total research was destroyed.
Oh, wow.
Just burned out, you know. The Math Research Center was on the first floor, and physics was on everything else.
Okay. Was the bomb on the first floor?
Yeah, the bomb was outside. The bomb was, you know, the alley between...
Yeah.
You know, the alley between Sterling and the pharmacy building.
Okay.
That driveway?
Yeah.
That's where they drove up. They drove up there with the truck and left the truck there.
Oh, I see, okay. I was wondering why Van Vleck hadn't been affected.
No, it was on that side.
It was on the other side, okay.
It was on the other side. It was between... That was the old physics building. It has since been rebuilt and renamed as the pharmacy building, although physics is still in it. And they drove up that alleyway, or roadway, and the bomb was right there.
Okay.
And I think it stunned. The bombing didn't stun people. The death stunned people.
Mm.
I think I don't. You know, again, I'm a faculty member. Students don't talk to me. But I think it did stun the campus, and it stunned. Stunned the movement on the campus.
Yeah.
In much the same way that Kent State provided an impetus for the movement all around the country. I don't know what the bombing did to the rest of the country, but I think here it slowed it down.
Okay.
But.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much.
All right.